Where will you be during tomorrow's solar eclipse? I'm Kay McIntyre, and today it's a celestial KPR presents, Two Astronauts, One Stellar Hour. We'll hear from astronauts John Grunsfeld, who works at NASA, and Steve Hawley, who teaches at the University of Kansas. They'll be talking about space travel and the popular movie and book, The Martian. But first, we'll turn our attention to tomorrow's solar eclipse. If you missed last week's KPR Presents and my conversation with KU astronomy professor Barbara Anthony Twarog, it's now archived at our website, kpr.ku.edu. You can also find an interview with David Barron. He's the author of American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. Again, you can find that show on our website, kpr.ku.edu, under news/KPR Presents. Towns across northeast Kansas are bracing for tomorrow's total solar eclipse. Atchison is one of the hot spots for watching the celestial event. KPR's Jay Schaefer spoke with Jackie Prejean, the president of the Atchison Chamber of Commerce, to find out what that town is expecting tomorrow.
Do you have any idea how many people are coming into Atchison for this?
Not really. We do the Amelia Earhart Festival every year, and this we've done 21 years, and we say we get probably 30 to 35,000 people for that each year. So we're kind of planning for that type of influx because we kind of know how to do that. So we've kind of used that as our template and say, let's say we're going to have that many people and plan it, and hopefully we'll be close.
Your events are taking place at the Amelia Earhart Airport, right?
Some are at the airport. Benedictine College actually is here, and they have all-day events happening up on the campus as well. And then we have Benedictine Sisters here as well, and so they're doing a retreat-style event on their campus. So those are the three main events. And then we have a lot of people that are just going to come to town because we're a great viewing place, and we've got 2 minutes and 19 seconds of totality, and they're coming to our parks. Coming to the riverfront, and other places that we probably don't even know.
Where will the president of the Atchison Chamber of Commerce be located during the solar eclipse?
I will be at the airport for a couple of reasons. We will have an information booth and some eclipse merchandise out there, if there's any left. And we also, last fall, acquired a Lockheed L-10E, which is the only remaining aircraft that is identical to the one Amelia Earhart was flying when she disappeared. So it is in a private hangar at the moment, waiting on us to build a museum. So we will have that open during the day because it's not open at all times for public viewing.
Is it free to go to the airport, or are you charging admission?
They were selling parking passes for $10. So $10 for your car, and then I guess if you want to load it up and see how many people you can poke in there. It'd be pretty cheap per person.
I assume that all the hotels and B&Bs in Atchison are chock full.
Everything is full. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. We actually had people out here at the Visitor Center on Thursday that were already in town for the eclipse. So we're building a brand new Holiday Inn Express, and they tried so hard to get it open but couldn't quite make it. So it's going to be another 2 or 3 weeks before they open. But, yeah, everything is full.
Is your house full? I'm just curious.
It is. Absolutely. And it's funny. I have a really good friend, and she said people keep calling, and I just finally said, you know, you can come, but my beds are full.
There's no room at the inn at Jackie's house.
There is no room at the inn, but you're certainly welcome to sleep on the floor. So there are a lot of full houses in town. We had a lot of people who'd say, you know, I can rent out my house. And we told them all, then you need to go to Airbnb because we're not going to be responsible, you know, for handling private things. And everybody, as soon as they posted on Airbnb, it filled up. So it's crazy.
Do you know if the local police department or the Atchison County Sheriff's Department is beefing up between Sunday and Monday just for traffic control and whatnot?
Absolutely, they are. We had several meetings for logistics and included, obviously, the sheriff and the police, but our emergency management people, our hospital people, our schools who decided as we got closer and closer to just dismiss school. So, yes, they have put together a plan for traffic control and hope to have everything under control. You know, we're just telling people if you're going to the airport, you need to go early. I think they're going to open at 7:30, and they'll have a speaker out there at 9:30 that came from the Vatican. Earlier is better.
Some expert from the Vatican. Talk about that.
Yeah, they actually are sending several people. Again, we're fortunate to have Benedictine College in town, and so they have sent some people over that are astronomers, and they are speaking at Benedictine, as well as one is going out to the airport to speak. You know, it's a gift dropped in our lap. It's our opportunity to shine. And so our goal for Monday is to make everybody feel welcome in Atchison County. And hopefully they'll have a great time and want to come back and see us again. It's fun to welcome visitors anytime. But like I said, this is just kind of a gift that was dropped in our lap. And we don't really know how many people are going to be here, but we're going to do our best to make sure they have a good time.
That's Jackie Prejean, the president of the Atchison Chamber of Commerce. She was speaking with KPR's Jay Schaefer about tomorrow's total solar eclipse. NPR and Kansas Public Radio will provide special coverage of the eclipse from noon until 2 o'clock on KPR2. The coverage will feature eclipse chasers, scientists, and reporters across the nation, and will follow the eclipse as it progresses across the U.S. Again, that special coverage of tomorrow's solar eclipse from noon to 2 o'clock on KPR2. During tomorrow's solar eclipse, many spectators across the country will turn their eyes upward to see the moon pass in front of the sun. But some scientists in the Midwest Farm Belt will turn their eyes and cameras to the ground. They'll be studying how plants and animals are affected by a total eclipse. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has this report.
First things first, a total eclipse occurs when the moon slides across the sun, blocking it completely. A different part of the Earth experiences a total eclipse about once a year. So says Angela Speck, director of astronomy at the University of Missouri-Columbia.
The place that gets to see that total eclipse is only about 0.1% of the surface of the Earth. So even though they happen every year, in a given location, they're very rare.
In the U.S., a 70-mile-wide ribbon from Oregon to South Carolina, called the Path of Totality, will experience the total eclipse. Large swaths of farmland in the Great Plains and Midwest will see darkness for 2.5 minutes and experience a temperature drop of about 10 degrees in the middle of the day. Will animal and plant behavior change? That's the question many scientists are considering, Speck says.
It's never really been studied systematically. And so we have ideas about, is this an illumination thing? You know, the amount of light they're receiving goes down. Is that what it is? Is it a temperature effect? Is it all of that?
Tim Reinbaugh wants to find out. He's the director of field operations at the South Farm Research Center in Columbia, Missouri. Today, he's driving across the farm to check where researchers will set up cameras to document corn, soybeans, and livestock.
So this is where our live stream is going to take place, right out here.
Pulling out a corn stalk in a pot, Reinbaugh says he's eager to see how drought-stressed corn and soybean plants react to the change in light and temperature during the eclipse. Typically, when these plants are coping with limited water, they twist up their leaves during the day to prevent loss of moisture. Then, during the night, they unfold to breathe in carbon dioxide.
During the middle of the day, during the middle of all this, will it unfold itself and then fold itself right back up in response to the eclipse? So I don't know if it's going to happen or not. Maybe it's too quick. You know, whether they work or not, we're going to learn something.
It's true, a lot of research is done in labs to see how plants react to different conditions, including research on drought-stressed plants. But Reinbaugh says the eclipse is so unique that it would be a challenge to recreate those exact conditions in a greenhouse or pasture.
And you just can't quite mimic that. Also, we've got the full spectrum with the sun. All the shades, red lights, green lights, blues. It's hard to get that artificially.
For farmers, the rows of corn and soybeans striping through the Midwest will only briefly dip in photosynthesis. University of Missouri plant biologist Manny Liscomb says any light or temperature changes that hit the crops during the eclipse will come out as a wash during harvest. No bushels lost.
And the reason for that is that plants normally are adapting to local environments because they're fixed in the soil, they're sessile. They can't escape their environment. So they undergo huge changes in their light environment during the course of a single day.
Animals, however, are not fixed in the soil. At the South Farm Research Center, Reinbaugh will have the cameras pointed at horses.
But either they're going to get really frisky, or they're going to want food. Who knows?
And at chickens in a coop.
I think when it gets even thunderstorms, they'll kind of go in. So I think they'll be real, real reactive to it. But then again, it's cool. They may say, you know, maybe I need to stay out here and eat some more. I don't know.
University of Missouri biology professor Candy Galen is even putting out microphones near beehives and in a pumpkin patch to record buzzing activity.
I don't really know. I don't think it is really known. The cues that bees use or don't use when they're foraging that tell them to, you know, jump ship and go back to their hives or stay put.
Researchers are also working with cattle ranchers and even fishermen to monitor fish activity throughout the eclipse, Reinbot says. He calls it
observational learning. What they observe, let us know. And you get enough folks observing the same thing, that's a replicated trial.
Ultimately, Reinbot says, sure, we might not learn a groundbreaking fact during these eclipse studies that can be applied immediately to science. But maybe something will be learned that researchers can use down the line in a breakthrough to improve food production. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. Harvest covers agriculture-related topics through a network of reporters and partner stations throughout the Midwest. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Carlson Center at Johnson County Community College. The 2017-2018 season includes John Cleese, William Shatner, Arlo Guthrie, and more. Information is at jccc.edu/Carlson Center.
It's a celestial KPR presents. For the rest of today's program, two astronauts, one stellar evening. That's the name of the Lawrence Public Library event featuring astronauts Steve Hawley and John Grunsfeld. Hawley was among the original class of space shuttle astronauts back in 1978. He flew five NASA missions and was responsible for launching the Hubble Space Telescope before he returned to his alma mater and became a professor of physics and astronomy at KU. John Grunsfeld has also flown five missions since joining NASA in 1992. He now is in the science mission at NASA. Hawley and Grunsfeld spoke on February 25, 2016 at a Read Across Lawrence event featuring the book and movie The Martian. This event was moderated by veteran ABC News reporter Lynn Shear, who has covered NASA and the space shuttle. She's the author of six books, including Sally Ride, America's First Woman in Space. The event begins with John Grunsfeld.
What we do is we innovate, we take technology and invent new things so that we can go out and explore. And this is really an essential human characteristic. When we go out and explore, we discover things. And I think we're actually genetically programmed to get, you know, joy and good feelings from discovering things. You know, the inspiration, the awe, the wonder is what drives us. And when we do, we are able to inspire. You know, I'm thrilled that Steve is back in Kansas inspiring new generations of students. Some of them are here. Some of them want to be astronauts. A few of them raised their hands going to Mars. We're trying to answer some really fundamental questions with NASA science. Things like, where did we come from? You know, where did the universe come from? How did it evolve? Where did the chemical elements that we're made of come from? It turns out that we were made inside of stars. The universe was formed with hydrogen and helium initially, a tiny bit of lithium, but all the heavy chemical elements that we're made out of, including the carbon, the oxygen, the calcium in our bones, the iron in our blood, are made inside of stars. And somehow, they have to get out of those stars into the cosmos where planets form and, you know, eventually where we were formed on Earth. So where are we going? What's the fate of the universe? But also, what's the fate of planet Earth? You know, we're affecting the future course of planet Earth. And then the question that really drives me the most is, are we alone in the universe? And this is the central question for why we're exploring Mars today. Of course, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. This is Carl Sagan next to a Viking lander. The 1970s, we landed two Viking landers on the surface of Mars, and it was a great disappointment. What we saw with the scientific instruments that we had was a dead and lifeless planet. And for about 20 years, we thought that that would be the case. But fortunately, we persevered, we sent more probes, and Mars started to look much more interesting. And so here we are on Mars today with the Curiosity rover, and our view of Mars has changed completely. as a result of the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, the Mars Exploration rovers, as a result of Curiosity, as a result of orbiting satellites observing the surface of Mars. We see a very different Mars today because we have better scientific instruments and our knowledge has just increased. It's an amazing landscape, and we have discovered some really fundamental things. The purpose of the Curiosity rover was to try and determine whether Mars ever in the past had an environment that could have been suitable for life. We call that a habitable environment. So we spend all this money, all this time, we send the rover off into space, 7 minutes of terror as it plunges through the Martian atmosphere, lands on the surface, we turn on the cameras, we look around, and right away we recognize that we landed in an ancient freshwater riverbed. And so that was the big question. We knew there was flowing water, we see pebbles that are rounded from being eroded by the water, and then we have analytical instruments that started to drill into the surface, and when we drilled into the red, rusted iron oxide surface, we got white rock out, not oxidized, and it turned out to be a kind of mudstone, and we analyzed it, and we found out that the place that we were in was sort of a river delta, and the water was fresh water, neutral pH, and easily would have supported life if life existed there. So we now know that Mars had a habitable environment. But we have these analytical chemistry instruments on the Mars Curiosity rover, and so we're able to do more. So we've now, from looking at the mineralogy, done a number of amazing things. First of all, we dated the rock. We used the chemical elements, the isotopes of those elements, some of which are radioactive, to determine the date at which this was a riverbed leading into a small freshwater lake. And it turned out to be about 3.8 billion years ago. Now, that's a long time. So since then, something happened to Mars, and we're going to try and figure that out. But the reason why that's an interesting date is because 3.5 to 4 billion years ago is when we think life started on Earth. So at the same time that life started on Earth, Mars was a happening place. It had a thick atmosphere, it had freshwater lakes, streams, probably snow-capped peaks, puffy clouds, rain. Did life start on Mars back then? That's what we're now trying to figure out. Could life have started on Mars back then? Probably. Did it? We don't know, but we're trying to figure that out. So one of the things we have is a special device that's called a mass spectrometer that can analyze what kind of molecules we're seeing in the rock. Now, this rock is 3.8 billion years old. If we go back to, first of all, we don't have rocks that old on Earth because of plate tectonics. They get subducted back down into the mantle. But when we looked at the oldest rocks, 2 billion years old, that have signs of life, when we analyze it, we see the crystalline structure. We don't see organic molecules and chemicals that are things like amino acids that we're made out of. But we do see some primitive organic molecules. Now, on Mars, as we're driving along, we've been analyzing. These are different places on Mars. We name them with cool names, Rock Nest, John Klein, a geologist, Cumberland. And in this one area in Cumberland, which was in an ancient river delta, we're seeing a lot of organic molecules. Now, it happens to be something called chlorobenzene. And we're seeing other organic molecules. But it's, I would just say, interesting and suggestive that we're seeing organic molecules where this river went into the freshwater lake. Now, we're continuing to drive. We're continuing to explore. And just like the Grand Canyon, at the bottom of the Grand Canyon are the oldest rocks, and you can record the history of the Earth as you go up towards the present. We're driving up Mount Sharp now to try and look at time as we get closer to the present and see if we can see other signs of organic molecules or other symptoms that might indicate that life was there, but also to try and figure out what happened. What happened to Mars' atmosphere? What happened to all the water on the surface? But that's not all. We're also seeing methane. Now, methane is a really interesting gas because cows produce methane. There's a lot of methane in Kansas. Bacteria produce methane. Termite mounds, the bacteria that live inside of termites, produce a lot of methane. In fact, that's one of the largest sources of methane on Earth. That's methane due to biology, but also the Earth produces methane. Volcanoes produce a lot of methane. There's methane under the ground in large quantities that we pump out, and a lot of it leaks into our atmosphere. So there's non-life, abiotic methane. But we're seeing that methane on Mars. Now, when we landed on Mars, we didn't see any methane. But as we drove along, all of a sudden we saw this big spike of methane. We continued to drive. We've only driven 12 kilometers so far, so it's not a very long way, about 8 miles. it's a robot, you know. Steve or I could do that in just a couple hours, but it's taken us 3 years with the robot. That's why we want to send people to Mars. Mark Watney, I mean, he went thousands of kilometers. And then we saw this big signal, and this corresponded to sort of springtime on Mars. So when it started warming up, we saw the signal of methane. We have no idea what it's from, but there is methane on Mars, and it's not constant. So there could be living microbes somewhere under the surface, or it could be geology. We don't know. So that's what we hope to figure out. Now, we saw Mars as a dry planet with Viking, but we've been orbiting Mars now for about 15 years looking at the surface. And when we get into spring and summer, we see these stains appearing on crater walls. And they're called recurrent slope lineae. It doesn't matter. That just means recurrent. We see them over and over again, year after year. They're linear, and they're on slopes. So geologists have to come up with names. But we see this all over Mars. And recently, using the spectrometer that can break the light up into its component colors, looking at these very large features hundreds of meters across, we were actually able to prove that this is water leaking out. Now, that may sound like, well, obviously, is, you know, must be water. What else could it be? Could be lots of other things. It could be due to, you know, wind or some other geological formation. But we've actually demonstrated that it's due to hydrated salts. So somewhere under this slope is an aquifer, probably frozen water, and it's very salty water, and it leaks out even though Mars is much colder than it is here on Earth, and it's because of the salt. Well, you know, in winter, you put salt on the road to melt the ice, so it's liquid water on Mars even though it's much colder. So we now know there's liquid water on the surface. Well, our quest in a search for life, just like on Earth, is follow the water. If you find water and you have the right chemical elements and you have the right chemistry or energy, everywhere on Earth you have that combination, we find life. And so we're doing the same thing on Mars. Follow the water, explore habitability. That's what we're doing now. Seek signs of life. We're sending new rovers in 2018 and 2020 that will actually have the ability to either detect organic molecules due to life or take samples that we can bring back to Earth and analyze for signs of life and prepare for human explorers. We sent in 2004 Spirit and Opportunity. Opportunity is still roving after all that time. It's gone about 30 kilometers. Curiosity is doing great work. And then we have the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's the one that found the water and takes the good pictures. MAVEN just arrived last year. Mars Odyssey has been up there for a long time. It has great cameras. And we also use the orbiting instruments for communications relays. And of course, in the book, there were 12 satellites in orbit, but apparently at Ares 3 base, they only had one antenna. But we'll talk about that later. This March, the European Space Agency is sending a mission called the Trace Gas Orbiter, and it's specifically going to be looking for those signs of methane. We were supposed to launch our Mars Lander, which is a geophysical seismometer monitoring station. We didn't make it this time, so we're going to launch that probably in 2018. And that's also when ESA is going to try and land its first rover, which has a molecular analyzer to look for organics. And then in 2020, we're going to launch a really comprehensive rover that has more capability than the current Mars Curiosity rover. It'll hopefully have the capability to go further and faster, but also it's going to take rock cores and put them into a sample container so that sometime later in the 2020s, we can land a rocket, put the samples in, launch it off, and bring those back to Earth. But we're also doing a step closer to human exploration with this mission. It's called MOXIE. So when people say, oh, you're going to Mars, you must have a lot of MOXIE. We do have one MOXIE. And this is called an in-situ resource utilization experiment. That just means we're going to use local resources, in this case Mars atmosphere, to create something we want. So we're going to take carbon dioxide in and then use a chemical process to create oxygen. Now, oxygen is really good because you can breathe it, you can pressurize it and liquefy it and use it for rocket fuel. So this is an important step towards getting humans to the surface of Mars, and we're going to demonstrate that on Mars starting in 2020. Now, we also have a cool radar that's going to be able to look into the ground, and this is really exciting for human explorers because we want to look for where there might be ice under the ground that we can just dig or pound a pipe down and get water out, because, of course, we like to drink water. Water is made out of hydrogen and oxygen, which is also great rocket fuel. Now back to The Martian, either the novel or the movie, and they're very different in you know, certain aspects of the technical, and so I like both of them. How about what they were doing? Why did they go to Mars? And this is one of the things I like the best. They went to Mars as a science mission. They were going to get rock samples. They were looking for signs of life. And I think it's probably when we can get astronauts to Mars for the first time, that's when we'll discover whether there was past life or whether there's current life, because we're just so much more capable at going to the right places, sampling, having the right instruments, drilling in difficult conditions, response to what we find. It's very hard with these robots to do exploration. That's why it takes 3 years to go 12 kilometers, why we can only do the simplest, slow things. Not the least of which is we don't want to accidentally drive the rover into a sand trap and have it get stuck. And that's kind of what happened to Spirit, you know, because we're not there. And the light travel time, our command time is so long, sometimes, you know, 20 minutes round trip, that you can't, you know, use a controller like a drone to drive it. So you have to be very careful. Now, one Mars year is about twice an Earth year, so takes a long time. Now, Mark Watt, Ares 3 crew supposedly arrived in 2035, and Mark Watney, and they were supposed to be there just about a month through part of Mars winter, and actually he had to go through winter, spring, and most of summer to get off, and of course we had lots of seasons here on Earth. One Mars sol, the time it takes for Mars to rotate, is about 24 hours and 39 minutes. And that may seem like it's really close to Earth's 24 hours, and it is. So if you're living on Mars, it's probably just fine, but if you're a Mars flight controller, that extra 39 minutes adds up. And so if you think you're working in the daytime, eventually you're working at night, and makes it very difficult on the families. Now, the book was pretty specific about where Ares 3 landed, and it's a pretty good place to go, actually. Here's where all the places on a Mercator projection of where we've landed on Mars. Most of them are near the equator. One of the Vikings was pretty high. And most of the north of Mars is very low elevation, low altitude. And we sent the Phoenix lander there to see if we could find signs of ice. And when we landed the Phoenix lander about a decade ago, the plumes from the rocket blew the dust off the surface, and we'd landed on a glacier of water ice. Mm. It was pay dirt, well, pay ice. So where does Ares 3 go? Well, it goes pretty close to where ExoMars is going and where Viking 1 and Pathfinder went, a few hundred kilometers away. And it's in one of these low areas. And why that's interesting is because Mars once had this very wet atmosphere. It probably had some kind of high elevation continents and then a big ocean. And Ares 3 supposedly landed somewhere where this ancient sea is. So a pretty good place to do science and look for signs of ancient life. Today we still see water on Mars. It's not that dry, dead planet that we think. Occasionally a new crater is made. Meteorite hits Mars, makes a new crater. And some of those craters, all the dirt on Mars' surface that's blown out, and when we look at it, we see snow, and we watch it for a few months, and the snow evaporates. And so just under the surface is this ice. There are some craters where in winter we actually see ice condensing, freezing, into the bottom of the crater. How about those dust storms? Well, we don't want to overanalyze the book or the movie, but there are real dust storms, and there's local dust storms, and they're pretty significant. And the Mars atmosphere is about 1/100th of what it is here on Earth. And so even 175 kilometer per hour wind, which is what is in the opening chapter of the book, would just be a light breeze. You barely feel it because the atmosphere is so thin. Nevertheless, the Martian surface has a lot of very fine dust, like talcum powder. And so we do see that those dust storms loft a lot of dust into the air. These dust devils travel around the surface of Mars, and these are high winds spiraling around, just like you probably get out here in the plains of Kansas. And as the dust devils go around and the wind comes around, it blows the dust off the solar rays. So Mark Watney probably didn't have to go out and clean off the solar rays the way he did. We also have those radioactive thermal generators, and they're really wonderful because they have no moving parts, they just produce electricity. So that was kind of a real thing. Of course, if you're producing electricity and heat, you probably wouldn't bury it 4 kilometers away. You'd probably use it. In fact, you'd probably have it in your habitat to keep warm. In the book, they kind of infer that it's too dangerous to have in the habitat. But of course, we have to certify that this can launch on a big rocket, and the rocket can blow up in Florida and not send pieces anywhere. It has to survive a rocket blowing up. So they're pretty beefy. Now, he made the trek from the Ares 3 to the Ares 4 landing site, which is a pretty incredible journey, 3,200 kilometers. It turns out that would have been a great science expedition because it's going uphill from the one site to another, and there's a lot of this lake sediment that he'd be driving over. Great chance to find fossils if they exist. It would have been really exciting. I don't think that's what was on his mind as he was going. So finally, the rover, you know, is that even vaguely realistic? And it turns out we're actually working on an electric rover that the movie was based on. You know, it was out in the literature, so probably in the book too. So I think with that, we've had 50 years of amazing Mars exploration, and the Mars we see today is not the dead, lifeless Mars that we imagined from the Viking missions. It's not quite the living planet that we imagined from science fiction, but there's a lot more to come. We have more Mars exploration, and we are working on a journey to Mars with humans sometime, hopefully in the 2030s. And we have, you know, some plans laid out. We're building a very large rocket called the Space Launch System that'll get us there. We have more rovers, more orbiters, new technology. So I think the future is going to be very exciting, and I think I'm ready to put the baton down. Thank you very much.
You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. You've just heard astronaut John Grunsfeld speaking at Liberty Hall at an event sponsored by the Lawrence Public Library. This event featured two astronauts, Grunsfeld and KU's own Steve Hawley.
It's really interesting to think about the history of how people on Earth have thought about Mars, and it really goes back to the 1800s when people started looking at Mars with telescopes. And there was a guy, an Italian named Schiaparelli, who looked at Mars and described what he called canali, and that was, which means channels, which is what he saw, but it was picked up by the press, no offense.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And translated as canals. And so suddenly now this image of an intelligent civilization on Mars who are building canals, for what purpose? Well, it was known from observations that Mars is similar to Earth in a variety of ways. As John mentioned, the rotation period is about the same as the Earth. The tilt of the Martian axis is about the same as the Earth. Mars has seasons, and in the summertime on Mars, the polar cap shrinks, and in the wintertime it grows. And it was natural for people to think, as the polar cap shrinks, it must be made of water. The water is coming, changing form from ice into liquid, and so these canals would be used by intelligent Martian civilizations to bring water for irrigation purposes. And it was also observed that the color on Mars changed with the seasons. And people thought, well, perhaps that's vegetation that's being enabled by liquid being funneled down from the poles. In 1915, thereabouts, there was an astronomer who was actually a pretty well-known astronomer named Arthur Hinks, who, among his other accomplishments, was one of the first to actually measure the distance from the Earth to the Sun, wrote an astronomy textbook, and in the textbook, basically as a throwaway, he said, well, it's obvious that there's life on Mars, so the only question is, are there other planets where there's life? And it's interesting to contemplate sociologically, you know, 100 years ago, people telling you it's obvious there's life on Mars. How did people react to that? I don't know.
And there was no second sentence after that. That was it.
That was pretty much it, yeah. And that's kind of how it stood until we developed the ability to launch robots to Mars, and we sent a probe, Mariner, to Mars to take the first up-close photographs. And truthfully, the results were disappointing. We didn't see civilization, we didn't see agriculture, we didn't see canals. What we saw was something that looked a lot like the moon. It was cratered, it was dry, it was desolate, there was no sign of life at all. As John mentioned, in the 70s, we sent Viking, which was two missions, each had an orbiter and each had a lander. And the landers and the Viking mission was designed to look for life. And that's what we told everybody we're going to do. We're going to go to Mars and look for life. The landers landed successfully, actually 7 years to the day after Apollo 11 landed on the moon, and began to conduct experiments to look for life. And there were some interesting reactions that were observed, but no life was discovered. And we said we were going to go look for life. We didn't find it. End of story. And people lost interest in Mars at that time. About 20 years later, a rock was found in Antarctica that was determined to have come from Mars. And it turns out that we actually have pieces of Mars on the Earth. Some meteorites that we collect originate on Mars, and we can tell by different assessment techniques, including looking at isotopic ratios of oxygen. And in this meteorite, which came from Mars, there was a suggestion by some scientists that it contained fossilized microbial life. And that result is still being debated today, although because of a number of the things that John described, the plausibility of there having been life 3.8 billion years ago on Mars is far more accepted today, I think, than it was at the time. But that renewed interest in Mars. And that led to reinvigoration of the Mars exploration program with Pathfinder,
right.
And then subsequently Spirit and Opportunity
and
Curiosity, and here we are. And now we understand so much more about Mars, and so much of what we understand is quite optimistic, frankly.
But still no little green man or little red
woman. Not yet. You know, Carl Sagan answered the question, you know, about the camera on Viking as one of the experiments to look for life. He says, well, if, you know, some tall Martian giraffe walks by, he'd like to get a picture of it. But so far, nothing.
So far, we haven't seen it. Okay, let's take a minute and add to some of what John talked about what the book/movie got right and what it got wrong. What's the main thing that the book got right? There's a lot of talk about the science, and he wants to really science it out and all that.
So I grew up on science fiction. In the seventh grade, somewhat randomly, I discovered on the bookshelf of my middle school library a book, Have Spacesuit Will Travel by Robert Heinlein. And ever since then, I've been a science fiction junkie. And as an experimental physicist, an engineer, and as an astronaut, it's hard for me to read a science fiction book and not pick it apart. So what do I think, you know, and why did I end up finishing the book and not put it down right away? It's because it's a wonderful story. And the human part of this astronaut's journey, I think Andrew Weir, the author, got just right. The fact that, you know, first of all, the human will to survive in sort of the human versus nature struggle. His creativity, I think one of the things that is valued as, you know, from astronauts is we know how to use duct tape.
It's not a joke. Yeah.
And how to improvise and how to solve problems in real time. And just that analytical thinking. I mean, it's a characteristic of scientists and engineers, you know, that we try and take, you know, the facts and rational thought and put them together in a way that results in some solution. You know, the spirit in which he tried to survive. And then for the rest of the crew, I think that, you know, the kind of discussions that they had once they found out that he was alive and the emotions they had when they thought he was dead. I mean, I think those are very real emotions. Steve has gone through two, you know, shuttle disasters. I went through one, you know, and it's a very emotional, you know, devastating experience. And I think that's what they probably felt heading back to Earth. I've always thought that the trip to Mars is going to be easy for those astronauts who go the first time because they have this exciting destination ahead of them. It's the trip back to Earth, you know, where they're putting Mars and this adventure behind them that's psychologically going to be harder.
But interesting. But
now these folks are going back to Earth knowing they lost one of their crewmates. And so it's that dynamic, that psychology
so
that I think
part
he, the human
real,
part,
right.
You know, was
Steve,
right on.
Steve, do you want to expand on that? Good. You can do either a good or a bad, I mean, a false or a true thing about it.
I enjoyed the book, and I enjoyed the movie. I thought the book was better. Part of the reason I enjoyed it because I saw Gravity first. And compared to Gravity, I thought The Martian did a really nice job of maintaining heritage
to
the science.
That most of the astronauts I know are not real big on Gravity. Their feeling is that movie didn't quite get it right.
Well, one thing that I remember the first time somebody asked me about the plausibility of the sequence of events in the book, and I remembered saying that, you know, I was listening to the probably Sports Center the week before the last season of the regular NFL schedule. Of course, the Chiefs had already made the playoffs. But they were talking about the Indianapolis Colts. And the Colts were still alive. And what they said, well, for the Colts to make the playoffs, these three teams need to win, these five teams need to lose, and everybody else needs to tie. Well, each of those outcomes individually is plausible. All of them together is probably not plausible. You know, Mark Watney is a lot smarter than I am. I don't have the skill set that he had to endure all of that and come up with all the solutions. But it was, I enjoyed the book, I enjoyed the movie. I think that John mentioned the dust storms. That was kind of a bit of an aw shucks, I think, for the book and the movie. But the idea of dust in the air on Mars is real, just as dust is real on the moon. Dust isn't in the air on the moon because there's no moon. But having talked to a number of the Apollo astronauts who did lunar EVAs, they all said that by the end of a second or third EVA, they probably wouldn't have been able to do anymore because dust was getting in the mechanism. They couldn't get their gloves off.
So can we, not everybody knows what an EVA is.
Oh, sorry. Spacewalk. So when you go out on the lunar surface, you're wearing your suit and dust gets in the mechanisms. And so it struck me as plausible that, yeah, a Martian dust storm may not blow the spaceship over, but you could imagine getting dust in your mechanism to the point where maybe it would be wise to have some limits on how much of that you could endure before you need to leave or it won't work.
As I understand it, the botany was pretty good in the book, the science of growing the potatoes.
It could be.
Oh.
Could be.
Not that good?
I think that was reasonably clever. You know, whether, you know, there's enough poop to be a good fertilizer for the soil. Potatoes actually like to grow in acidic soil. And so there are places, I think Spirit Rover, I think specifically the area where it was driving was pretty acidic. Other parts of Mars are very alkaline. You okay. can grow broccoli or other things.
Let's talk a little bit about the real problems that humans would face on Mars. And we've got the obvious ones, food, water, air, heat. I mean, these are big, Mars is a lot colder than we are, the atmosphere, the density. How do we solve those problems? And what do we tackle first in terms of humans going to land there?
Well, I think the first problem is Mars has this very thin atmosphere, a hundredth of the density of ours. And so there's just enough atmosphere to make it hard to land and not enough to help you. So the problem of entry, descent, and landing to the surface is going to be much more challenging than anything we've ever done before. On the moon, as Steve said, there's no atmosphere. So it's pretty simple. You use rockets to slow down and land, and we've done that. We did that 6 times. We've done it with robotic landers. The Curiosity rover weighs about 2,000 pounds. That's the largest thing we know how to land on Mars. And that's not very much when we have to land a habitat and, you know, storage and a rover and all the equipment. One of the things that I think Andrew Weir got right in the book is that they sent a lot of stuff ahead of time on the surface so that it would be ready to go by the time the crew arrived there. And I think that's...
Sent it robotically,
had it, you know, land as close... Precision landing is one of the challenges that we have. Landing as close together as they could, so once the crew got there, they could, you know, go between elements. And then the Mars Ascent Vehicle... They landed robotically and had it produce its own fuel, like the ISRU that we're working on, the in-situ resource utilization, create your own fuel from the Mars atmosphere. They had it fuel itself before the crew got to Mars. And actually, in the book, he describes how if, by the time they got to Mars, the return rocket wasn't ready, they would just slingshot around Mars and go straight back to Earth. They wouldn't go down to the surface. And all of those kind of strategies are things we're talking about, developing technology for. The challenge of the temperature,
right.
Even though it's really cold, it's the daytime temperature, you know, can get a little bit above freezing, but it can go down, you know, much colder than on Earth, minus 120 degrees, you know, colder than Fairbanks, Alaska, colder than Antarctica by quite a bit. But when you're in a spacesuit, you're well insulated.
Right.
And if you're in your habitat, and especially if you cover the habitat with dirt, Mars dirt, which will also protect you from the radiation. Inside, it'll be pretty comfortable.
How about, Steve, what about the Mars is one-third the gravity of Earth,
yeah.
Right? Which means what? You're a little bit bouncy there?
You're a little bit bouncy, not probably as much as you've seen in the videos of the Apollo astronauts on the lunar surface. One of the things that is interesting that we still need to determine is how much a third G is worth in terms of your physical well-being. We've got, of course, lots of data on how people do in a one-gravity environment.
Here on Earth.
We've got a lot of data. We're going to get more when Scott gets home on how people
Scott
do.
Scott Kelly's 1 year on the space station is about to end.
And we had a number of astronauts and cosmonauts fly for 6 months, so we have some understanding of what it's like for that period of time in weightlessness. So the question, one of the interesting questions is, what does that trajectory look like between the data point at 1G and the data point at 0G? Does a third of a G, is that close enough to 1G that a lot of things we worry about in 0G don't matter that much? Things we worry about are deconditioning. You lose bone mass, you lose muscle mass, pharmacology doesn't work as well. There are just some things that affect you long term. It takes dedication to exercise to try to maintain your physical condition, and even with that, people come back and aren't able to walk easily, usually
right.
for several
and
days.
And let's get some of the parameters here. You say, John, possibly human spaceflight to Mars in the 2030s. By then, figuring out how to get there, how long is the journey there?
About 6 months.
6 months there.
6 months there. Six to eight months back.
6 to 8 months back.
Yep.
And how long would the shortest amount of time be that we would say is reasonable to stay there for the first couple trips?
About 5 minutes. No, just kidding. depending upon what kind of rocket you have to get home, somewhere around a month. Not longer, though.
So 6 months around a month there. So it's a year and a half, little under a year and a half.
Yeah. But if you stay longer than a month, then you're there for hundreds of days. Until the Earth comes all the way around.
And I got a chance to work with General Stafford in the synthesis group back, 25 years ago on the first, among the first mission to Mars architectures. And that was an interesting discussion. You know, if you're the first crew and you're going to Mars, you want to stay 30 days, you want to stay a year.
Right.
Big difference.
What about, there have been conversations, probably not at the highest levels, but about people wanting to go to Mars and signing up not to come back, saying they want to go and they want to colonize it. How far is that practicable? How far away is that?
I don't think, that's practical for quite a while. I mean, I think 100 years from now, definitely, that's a reasonable expectation. Mm-hmm. But it gets back also partly to human physiology. I mean, do you want to go there as your retirement, or do you want to go there and have a family? You know, having strong bones and muscle.
And can you have a family there?
I think that on the International Space Station, I think we've actually cracked that nut, that we can have people in microgravity and they come back and their bones and muscles are as strong or stronger than when they left.
If they exercise, if they...
And it's, a big NASA secret, so I can't tell you, but but I will anyway. It's diet and exercise.
Yeah.
No, seriously, it's not, there's no miracle drug that we're giving astronauts now, but the exercise has to be really, you have to be really dedicated, as Steve said. You know, if you just sort of do, little woofy stuff, it's not going to help. You have to work out a couple hours a day, very heavy weights. We do that, by having machines that pull down on you because you're floating, so you have to work. And then you have to have a good diet that includes vitamin D. For the first, 20 years of the space program, on both the Mir space flights, the Salyuts, the Russians, and then on International Space Station, we weren't giving crew members vitamin D. And we know from research on the ground, endocrinology is the medical field, that you need vitamin D to build bones, muscle, cardiovascular tone, the immune system, brain function. And the measurements we had are people were coming back so depleted in vitamin D. We've now supplement that. They get good exercise. There's no sunlight, so you don't build it in your skin the way you're supposed to. And so we've had...
No sunlight because you're wearing a spacesuit?
No, because you're in a module with windows that protect you from the ultraviolet light of the sun.
Of course. Yeah. All right, so we didn't talk about radiation. Radiation going, that's a big problem, right? The radiation as you're near the sun or as you on the way or in the sky, in the universe. How do we deal with that?
Well, we're lucky here on Earth because we have two things. We have a magnetic field, and that helps to deflect charged particles away from the Earth at high energy particles, and a thick atmosphere. And so that shields us as well. There is a lot of cosmic radiation. As we sit here, there's cosmic rays zipping through our body. But fortunately, it's a low rate, and we evolved in that environment. Once you get out of that protective cocoon, either going to the moon, going to Mars, deep space, now you're exposed to the solar radiation and galactic cosmic rays, ones coming in from other stars.
For six months.
And we don't have a lot of data on that. Now, the solar events, you know, a big solar flare or something like that, those are almost entirely just protons. And so just a single proton traveling at very high velocities. But we can shield that with aluminum and water and the materials that might be in the spaceship. And so you'd have to have some kind of a solar storm shelter, you know, with a lot of water. But if you're going to Mars, you're going to need a lot of water anyway.
Right.
The galactic cosmic rays are atomic nuclei that are high energy and much heavier, and we can't shield those currently. But we don't know what human physiology does. That's some of the research we still have to do.
So this is all data that NASA has to get, or whoever's going to do it, before anybody goes. And that's actually my next question. What's the most reasonable scenario for getting to Mars? Is it NASA alone? Is it NASA and private commercial space? Is it NASA and other countries like Russia? Where do we go from here? How do we do this?
Well, I know we've spent some time looking at the possibilities of an international collaboration to undertake something like that. It has advantages, of course. It's also very challenging to put together. It's quite a challenging undertaking in terms of technology, but also, of course, in terms of cost.
Well, in the book, it was China that came through,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, politically today, I'm not sure that's something that would work. But one of the things I was at a conference several years ago where we were talking about the nature of international partnerships for space exploration. And one of the things that's evolved over time is how you put together a mission or a series of missions where everybody's national interest is respected and accommodated in the mission design. I mean, it's one thing to say, the United States will be the lead and we're going to do all this stuff and you guys can build a little device that, you know, we'll deploy on the surface of Mars or something like that. Well, that may not be in their national interest. That may not be enough to engage their people and their political system. So how do you do it in a way that, and one thing it may take is allowing somebody else to be in the critical path. That's one thing that... Well, historically, at least in my career, we have always said, well, the important stuff we're going to do.
Right.
Because we want to make sure it works.
We, NASA, the U.S.
Other people can participate, but we don't want them to, you know, be so important that if they don't meet their obligations, this thing doesn't work. And it may be to make something like that work, you have to give that up.
And what about commercial space ventures? And where is NASA today in terms of the private-public partnership?
Well, NASA has always used the commercial sector to build things. You know, NASA actually doesn't build very much. We have the engineers and scientists who come up with ideas, and then we pay commercial companies to build those things. You know, the Apollo rockets, the command module on Apollo, the lunar module, the space shuttle, all the parts of the space shuttle. We've always contracted. Now we're moving to a slightly different model. So back then, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, nobody knew how to build rockets. Nobody knew how to build spaceships. And so NASA provided all the leadership with people who also didn't know how to do it, but we were taking the leadership role. And so through the 60s and 70s, 80s, 90s, through 2000, you know, we really refined how to build rockets, how to build reusable rockets. You know, we flew, you know, over 100 space shuttle missions where we reused the space shuttle and lots of the parts. We demonstrated vertical takeoff and vertical landing with some of our X-plane developments, our X-rocket developments. You know, all of these techniques, how to build engines. So now, all of that knowledge is in the public sector, and we have companies like SpaceX, like Blue Origin, who are using that technology to build rockets where NASA's not telling them exactly how to do it. You know, they're figuring that out and then, you know, selling those services to NASA. And then to, you know, people who want to launch satellites. So that's a new model because we have 50-plus years of spaceflight heritage now. So I think it's an interesting new model. And
so it's kind of spreading out in different directions.
It's spreading out in lots of different directions for different reasons.
But it's also enabling NASA to put more emphasis on the new things, exploration, and hopefully looking towards Mars.
Okay, and as long as you mention that, I have to ask, does this country right now have the political will to go forward with NASA? Is there a mandate, either with any administration that comes in? Do you? I know there's been a lot of frustration at NASA with budget cuts. How do you see it?
Of course, I'm seeing it from the inside.
Yeah.
But you know, as I said, we're on Mars today. You know, we're building a multi-billion-dollar Mars lander for the 2020s with people that has, you know, new capabilities. You know, this quest to find out if we're alone in the universe, I think, is absolutely something that, I don't know. Who else wants to know whether we're alone in the universe? No, for the first time in human history, you know, we have the technology and we have the knowledge to answer that question, whether it's on Mars or Europa, moon of Jupiter, which has a vast undersea ocean.
But you're constantly fighting for your budget.
Actually, I find when I go over to Congress or I go over to the White House, a lot of support for NASA. You know, we have a great budget. We have a $19 billion budget now, you know, higher than it's ever been, and enormous support for science. We have Congress asking us to do more science than we even propose. And so I think it's a great time. And I think that the desire to send humans to Mars is getting a lot of momentum, and in part because of books like The Martian.
I was going to ask, to what extent has the book and then the movie been helpful to you at NASA?
Well, Ridley Scott, the producer of the movie, is well known for making great films like Alien, Blade Runner, you know, many others. And they're all very, you know, creepy, weird movies, but have a lot of realism. So now The Martian comes along, and it's a happy story, more or less. And, you know, not for the potatoes, but it has that sense of realism, I think, that combined with what we're doing in space and the space station and our science missions, paints a picture that, you know, we're on the cusp of being able to send people to Mars.
Let me ask you, John, the line, I love the line when Mark Watney starts growing his potatoes and it's actually working, and he says, I don't want to come off as arrogant here, but I'm the best botanist on the planet. Is there a moment when you're up there, when you're doing a spacewalk, when you're floating around, when you're thinking, I'm pretty cool what I'm doing here?
You know, Steve and I have been on multiple Hubble flights, and these repairs that we do on Hubble are often very hard, sometimes ridiculously hard. And on the last mission, 2009, I had to take out some tiny screws. They're number 4 torque set screws, if anybody's a mechanical engineer. You know, very tiny, like almost like eyeglass screws. How do you take out tiny screws in space? Tiny screwdriver. But it was just a bad setup. The panel I had to remove was off on the side, so I couldn't see it with both eyes all the time, and these tiny screws couldn't lose any. And then I had to pull out circuit cards, and we'd never done anything like this before. And I'd practiced so much on this task that, you know, I was pretty confident I could do it, but it wasn't for certain, and that we had 2.5 hours to do it. And if we couldn't finish it, they were going to close it off, and we wouldn't have these amazing Hubble pictures that we have today. And I trained to do it in 2 hours and 30 minutes. It took 2 hours and 32 minutes. And when I was done, I actually felt pretty good. Didn't lose a single screw.
All right.
That's astronauts John Grunsfeld and Steve Hawley speaking with ABC reporter Lynn Scheer. This Lawrence Public Library event was recorded February 25th, 2016. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.